You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After the election, we should probably expect to see a renewed debate over a controversy that's been largely swept under the rug in recent months, how to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court that was created when Antonin Scalia died last February. With the current eight justices more or less evenly divided, the court has already undergone significant changes, and we can expect more to come, whoever wins the election. Jeffrey Toobin has considered the future of the nation's top court in his latest New Yorker article called In the Balance, and you can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org/Lopate. I'm very pleased it has brought Jeffrey Toobin back to our show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
I said swept under the rug, but yesterday the Times had an editorial, and they called a Republican refusal to move on the nomination of Merrick Garland unprecedented stonewalling. Haven't there been past instances of Supreme Court seats going unfilled for an extended period of time?
Never like this. This is really an extraordinary, premeditated example of just complete defiance of the president. I mean, remember, Justice Scalia died in February when President Obama had 11 months left in his term, which is a long time. It's nearly a quarter of his term.
It's definitely not a lame duck period.
No, and there are all these quarrels about whether there are precisely analogous situations. Justice Kennedy was confirmed in 1988. He was nominated in 87 but confirmed in 88 in a presidential election year. But, you know, this sort of outward open defiance announced by Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, within an hour of Justice Scalia's death, certainly there's been nothing like that.
And what grounds?
I mean, I think when it comes right down to it, the grounds are because he could do it. He has absolute control of the Senate calendar. He understands what an epically important seat this is. This would not only be a vacancy on the Supreme Court, which is always important, but a chance to flip the court to a liberal majority for the first time really since the early Nixon administration. So I think it was simply a matter of exercising the power that he had because the stakes were so high.
He's assuming that Donald Trump's going to win the presidency then.
Well, he wasn't, I think, assuming that, but he was recognizing that Barack Obama is president now. And there was and is at least a chance that Donald Trump would win. So why not leave open the possibility of filling the seat with a Republican nominee as opposed to filling it with a guaranteed
If Hillary Clinton wins the presidency but the Republicans hold the Senate, could the GOP continue to block a replacement?
The answer is yes. It will be a lot easier for the Republicans to block a Hillary Clinton nominee if they continue to hold the majority in the Senate, which is not a sure thing. I mean, the polls show the Senate is very much in the balance, even closer than the presidential race. You know, I do think that keeping a seat open for 4 years is very difficult, and McConnell has certainly said that if Hillary Clinton wins, the next nominee will get a hearing and get a vote. It doesn't mean that nominee will be approved, but it will at least be procedurally different from the complete defiance that the President Obama has gotten with the Garland nomination.
If Donald Trump were to win and nominate a conservative, could the Democrats block it?
You know, this is a difference between how the parties generally behave. The Democrats, while no shrinking violets, I don't think would have said we are not even going to hold a hearing for 11 months. I mean, the Democrats have played hardball with judicial nominations. When Harry Reid was the majority leader, they invoked the nuclear option, which allowed President Obama to fill a lot of lower court seats. But I don't think there is really any possibility the Democrats would simply say no hearing, no vote for a Donald Trump nomination to the Supreme Court. So I do think the next president, Clinton or Trump, will fill this seat.
Does the Constitution mandate how many justices must sit on the court?
No, it's actually an interesting question. When I started studying the court, I didn't realize this was not the case. And the number of justices has fluctuated over the years. It only was set at 9 during the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. Earlier, Congress hated Andrew Johnson so much that when a Supreme Court justice died during his tenure as president, they simply cut the number of justices on the court so they couldn't allow him to fill the seat. Notoriously as well, President Franklin Roosevelt tried to increase the number of seats on the court for elderly justices as part of his court packing plan, which failed. But it just shows that the Supreme Court is and always has been a political body.
But always an odd number, so that to be a majority.
There have been times when the court had an even number. I mean, the traditions of dissenting opinions as a frequent, regular occurrence was not really in place in the early days of the Supreme Court. When Chief Justice John Marshall presided from 1803 to 1835, there were not many dissenting opinions.
So why is it that precedent can only be set when you have a majority?
Well, because there is a rule at the Supreme Court that when the court splits 4-4, the lower court opinion is affirmed, and that remains the law of the circuit, one of the 12 circuits, each covering a handful of states, but it does not create a national precedent, and that has come up a number of times since Justice Scalia's death. Because the court is so evenly divided, and there have been important cases resolved on those 4-4 votes.
Did the Republicans treat this vacant seat as the Scalia seat reserved for someone with views similar to Scalia's?
Well, I mean,
the reason I ask is I wonder if anybody has views similar to Scalia. He called himself an originalist, and are there other originalists?
Well, there are certainly other conservatives who would certainly vote very much like Justice Scalia. Donald Trump has done something very unusual for a presidential candidate. In fact, something that I'm aware of no other presidential candidate has done. He has made public a list of, I believe it has 21 or 22 people on it, mostly judges, but also Senator Mike Lee of Utah, saying, I will pick from this list my nominee to the Supreme Court. And I think that list represents justices who would almost certainly vote very much like Justice Scalia, whether they had the same ideological underpinnings on originalism, I think is harder to say, but certainly they'd vote a lot like Justice Scalia.
I'm speaking with Jeffrey Toobin, whose latest article in The New Yorker, last week's issue, is In the Balance, the Supreme Court After Scalia. Didn't many people expect Hillary Clinton to make a campaign issue of the GOP's tactics? Has it come up in any campaigns?
You know, this is something I've now been covering the court for a long time, and one of the questions I always get from informed people on both sides of the political spectrum is, why isn't the Supreme Court a big issue in these campaigns? It's so important. But the sad truth, for better or worse, is that it never is. You know, it is simply too abstract for most voters. The candidates answer questions about it. You know, Trump made public his list of nominees. Hillary Clinton has made clear her support for Merrick Garland. But it just never catches fire. You would think this is the one year that it might, because the court is in the balance. But it just, the public doesn't respond in great numbers.
But is that true because evangelicals are saying that they are ignoring a lot of the things that might have turned them off about Donald Trump because of abortion? And the abortion issue is a Supreme Court issue. They see this this election as an opportunity to get rid of abortion, or the alternative would be that a more liberal court would expand abortion rights.
Well, you're right that there are definitely some voters on each side who care passionately about this. And it is true particularly among like someone like Paul Ryan, who was obviously the Speaker of the House, who was not infatuated with Donald Trump, says, well, we have to support him because he'll nominate the right people to the Supreme Court. So it's not like it's an invisible issue. But if you look at the public campaign, if you look at the debates, for example, it almost never comes up. At neither convention, I don't believe that either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump mentioned the Supreme Court in their acceptance speeches. Certainly, it didn't come up. President Obama, I know, didn't mention it in his speech. It is simply not an issue that appears to galvanize large numbers of voters.
NYU law professor Richard Reves, you quote him as saying that the conservatives on the court have shown an attitude of hostility toward the Obama administration beyond simply disagreeing with some of his policies?
Well, they have certainly rejected his use of executive power in certain very important areas.
Even though executive power was expanded under a number of previous Republican presidents as well as Democrats.
That's the question of whose ox is gored. It comes up in my piece, particularly when it comes to the environment, EPA regulations. Whether the president has the unilateral authority to impose restrictions on greenhouse gases and things like that. There have been several rulings against the president in this regard, again, along ideological lines at the court.
So the court has become politicized in the same way that Congress has become more polarized politically?
This is where I tend to sort of defend the court, as it were. I don't think the court has ever been not politicized. When you look at the kinds of issues that go before the court, does the Constitution protect a woman's right to choose abortion? Can a university consider race in admissions? There is no apolitical way to decide those questions, and there's never been an apolitical way to decide those questions.
When slavery became an issue, obviously.
1857, the Dred Scott case, in many respects set off, was one of the precipitating factors of the Civil War. It's always been at the core of our politics. I prefer to be more open about how political the court is, not to pretend there is some perfect legal answer to all these very political questions.
So this is the first day of arguments in the Supreme Court's new term. How does the docket look?
Thin. One thing
would be different if Scalia was still alive,
yes,
or Merrick Garland had been appointed.
Absolutely.
To the court.
I mean, they are very self-consciously, it seems, kicking cans down the road. They don't like it, understandably, to turn out 4-4 cases. They think it reflects badly on the court. It doesn't resolve the issues that the Supreme Court is supposed to resolve. So there are a lot of cases about things like patents, which don't address issues that a lot of people are following.
And no potential landmark cases.
Not as far as I'm aware. I mean, there are always important cases, but in terms of the issues that the Supreme Court is associated with, church-state, abortion, gay rights, there are no blockbusters yet. I mean, it's still early in the term, and they could certainly add them.
You point out in your article that there are other reasons that people are, conservatives especially, are concerned about the possibility of a Democratic president. A number of the justices are fairly old.
As I get old, they don't seem as old. No, they are pretty old by any standard. Ruth Ginsburg is 83. And Leonard, 83 is not the new anything. It's 83 is 83. Anthony Kennedy is 80. Stephen Breyer is 78. Clarence Thomas is 68. The court does have generational changeover. Now, John Paul Stevens served until he was 90. So, life tenure for these people really means life tenure in certain circumstances. But certainly, if you look at the law of averages, if you look at how the ages as which Supreme Court justices have traditionally retired, it does look like in the next 4 or 8 years you could see substantial turnover.
A couple of listeners have called in to ask, how is the refusal to nominate a ninth judge not treasonous? Shouldn't it be considered as such?
You know, the answer is this is a power given to Congress, but that Congress does not, the Constitution does not impose a time limit. It doesn't say it has to be done within a certain period of time. And the check on the senators who are failing to exercise this power is political. If people don't like it, they can vote it out of office. Again, a lot of people thought that the vulnerable Republican senators would have to, you know, would pay a political price for this obstruction. You know, Johnson in Wisconsin, Toomey in Pennsylvania, Ayotte in New Hampshire. You know, they are all in trouble politically, but it does not appear like the Supreme Court is the main reason they're in trouble. It just never takes hold with voters or substantial numbers of voters.
And we've seen flip-flops in a way. Orrin Hatch is one of the people opposed to even hearings about Merrick Garland. And yet he said when Garland was first proposed that he was a consensus nominee.
You know, I have to say, I have covered Orrin Hatch for a long time, and I actually have a great fondness for Orrin Hatch. And one of the sad things about how polarized our politics have become is that people like Hatch, who is very conservative and a very thoughtful guy, have become, you know, swept up in this partisan rancor. And, you know, he knows that among Democrats who could be nominated, Merrick Garland is among the most moderate. And in the old days, as those quotes illustrated, he would have rushed to confirm Merrick Garland. But the Senate's a very different place from when Orrin Hatch arrived, and he reflects that.
Has Hillary Clinton said that she's going to stick with Merrick Garland?
You know, this is really something I learned in writing this New Yorker story that I wasn't aware of. The answer is no. She has not. She's kept a very studied ambiguity on that question, insisting that the Senate should confirm Garland now, period. But I spoke to a lot of Democratic senators, and they were unanimous in their belief that if Clinton wins, she should renominate Garland because they think Garland will get through. They you know, because he's a moderate, because he's 63 years old and not likely to serve for many decades, that Republicans will complain and perhaps vote against him, but he will not be rejected. They don't want a whole new fight with a new nominee to soak up the first 6 months of Hillary Clinton's term. And that argument struck me as something likely to persuade Hillary Clinton to nominate Merrick Garland so that she could push the rest of her agenda.
And then, of course, as we said, there probably will be other nominations as well. But there's also other courts to be considered. I know we're talking about the Supreme Court, but the lower courts, there's been a stalemate there as well. Although Obama has gotten through, at least in the first 6 years of his term, pretty much what his predecessors got through. And then for the last 2 years, there's been stonewalling on the lower courts, and there are an awful lot of vacancies, meaning there's a lot of backlog.
There's a lot of backlog. The next president is going to have a big group of judges to fill. You know, I think one of the untold stories of the Obama administration is that in the last 2 years of, or the first 2 years of Obama's second term, when the Democrats controlled the Senate and Harry Reid was the majority leader, Reid understood that the House of Representatives was not going to pass much legislation favorable to him. So the thing he could do to help President Obama cement his legacy was to push judges through. And Harry Reid did an extraordinary job. They invoked the so-called nuclear option so that it only took a majority, not 60 votes, to cut off debate on judges. And that was when Obama really had the chance to put his stamp on the federal judiciary, which he did. And there are a lot of young, liberal judges sprinkled throughout the federal system. And that is as much due to Harry Reid as it is to Barack Obama.
But not the last 2 years.
No, and the Republicans in the Senate were quite aware of what Harry Reid was doing. And McConnell, who is very focused on the issue of judges, was unwilling to let Obama fill any more seats, and judicial nominations have nearly ground to a halt.
Well, many people bring up Robert Bork as a precedent, and a listener asked, didn't Chuck Schumer and the Democrats do the same thing when Bush came in, go against his judge nominee?
Well, they certainly didn't do anything on this scale. I mean, you know, Robert Bork was voted down. He had a hearing, and then the Senate voted him down, 58-42. What I think the difference is, Obama's nominee didn't even get a hearing. He didn't even get the chance to be voted down in a committee or in a Clarence Thomas was confirmed by a Democratic Senate 52-48. So they didn't even filibuster Clarence Thomas. If they had filibustered him, he would have been rejected. So, you know,
despite the hearings that made him sound like a less than ideal candidate.
Yeah, yes.
Joe Biden
elegantly put, Mr. Lopate, a less than ideal candidate. Yes, I think that's one way to describe the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. But the it is a there is this sort of, you know, they started it that goes on for all these, you know, judicial nomination fights. The fact is, it's been ugly for a long time, but the Garland Stonewall is a new level of obstruction.
In the case of naming justices, Hillary Clinton went to law school and she has practiced law. Is there any indication of how that affects her thinking about the court as opposed to Donald Trump, who did not?
I mean, we know a lot more about Trump's prospective nominees since he's named them, and they are Mike Lee, who's the former senator, the current senator from Utah, very thoughtful former clerk for Samuel Alito, and, you know, very conservative judges in the circuit courts and the state supreme courts. Hillary Clinton has been more reticent to talk about these issues. I think diversity will be a big factor. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg steps down, I think it's almost certain that she would that Hillary Clinton would appoint a woman to replace her. Another African American like Paul Watford, who's a judge on the Ninth Circuit, Sri Srinivasan, who's a judge on the D.C. Circuit, who might be the first American of Indian descent to go on the court. I mean, I think those will be factors that she considers. And I think youth matters. You know, we live in a world with life tenure, which I think is a bad idea, but presidents take advantage of it, and they want justices who will serve a long, long time.
Is it ironic that Mitch McConnell said that the voters should decide, but we don't vote for Supreme Court justices, we vote sometimes for local judges?
Well, the whole notion of an elected judiciary is so awful and so pernicious.
But it's a reality. But
in some states, in too many states. You know, interestingly, Sandra Day O'Connor, when she stepped down, one of the causes she embraced was trying to persuade states to have appointive as opposed to elected judiciary. She had mixed success in that. But, we do elect presidents and we do elect senators, and they're the ones who decide who's on the federal judiciary. And, you know, it's my hope that voters take that into consideration. But sadly, only a handful seem to.
If businesses and others that lean conservative have tried to bring cases to the conservative court, who might be anticipating appealing to a liberal court? Would we see very different kinds of cases?
Well, we might. I mean, this is something that I think people haven't really realized, that even in the past year, the fact that there are four Democratic appointees who can essentially veto any opinion they don't like currently, we are seeing, at least currently, for the time being, a more liberal Supreme Court. The one area where I'm certain that you will see a lot of cases be brought to a liberal Supreme Court, if there is one, is voting rights. Many Republican-dominated states have passed restrictions on voting, whether it's restrictions on absentee voting, early voting, photo ID requirements. The courts are starting to get more aggressive in cutting back on those. That's one area where I think a liberal Supreme Court would make a big difference.
And the circuit courts have decided on some of them, and the Supreme Court has not yet ruled, well, has allowed those decisions to stand. So does that mean that those decisions will affect this current election?
Yes. North Carolina and Texas, both of which passed very restrictive voting laws in recent years, substantial parts of those laws have been overturned.
Even if they've appealed to the Supreme Court.
Right. And they have not, the Supreme Court has decided not to overturn the rejection of those plans by more liberal judges, which just shows how important it is to have lower court judges who share your ideological perspective.
But then if Donald Trump wins and a conservative winds up on the court, could they come back those states?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How did Scalia's presence affect how the justices work? How could the regular work of the court change if a Democratic president gets one or two nominations?
Well, I'm
thinking about in terms of
this.
I'm thinking about assignments. You quote law professor Noah Feldman, who says the assigning power
is
very
meaningful. Right.
And Scalia played a role in
that. Well, that's right. I mean, the rule at the Supreme Court is the Chief Justice assigns who writes the opinion if he is in the majority. But if he's not in the majority, the longest tenured justice, the senior justice in the majority, assigns the opinion. If you have five Democratic appointees, Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be the senior justice in that majority. She would then have the assigning power in 5-4 cases that she won. That's a big deal. And she could assign those opinions to herself. It also suggests that she might not be in such a big hurry to retire if she has that power. So one point I raise in the article is that we might actually see Stephen Breyer, who is the next senior justice, 78 years old, 5 years younger than Ruth Ginsburg, he might actually be the first justice to retire under a Hillary Clinton presidency, not Ruth Ginsburg, as many people have thought.
We don't have much time, but I want to address the issue of Anthony Kennedy, who President Reagan nominated after Bork was rejected. He's been considered the swing vote, but you suggest that he's become more conservative recently, although so often he votes in a way that isn't conservative.
I would have said that a year ago, but in this past term, he sided with the liberals in two of the most important cases on affirmative action at the University of Texas and rejecting the Texas abortion laws, both of which were among the more liberal decisions in many decades on those two issues. You know, I have spent all too much of my journalistic career trying to figure out what the hell Anthony Kennedy is thinking. And it's a difficult enterprise. I mean, here's a guy who is the single biggest hero of the gay rights movement, who has written every important Supreme Court decision on gay rights, including Obergefell, legalizing gay marriage in all 50 states, striking down the Defense of Marriage Act. He's also the author of Citizens United, the case that liberals hate perhaps more than any other in recent years. So, he is a difficult judge to figure out.
They all surprised. Chief Justice John Roberts surprised and disappointed conservatives with a recent decision.
Two Obamacare decisions, yeah. And that's it. You know, this is something I like to push back on, this idea that justices surprise the presidents who appoint them. It happens damn rarely. You know, it mostly dates, this notion of surprise, to the Eisenhower administration, when Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren as Chief Justice, William Brennan, who turned out to be big liberals, and they were surprises. But Lenny, I think one thing we can agree on about the Eisenhower administration, it was a long time ago. And if you look at the justices since then, by and large, with a handful of exceptions on a handful of cases, what you see is what you get.
And probably Dwight D. Eisenhower would be a conservative Democrat today.
You know, that's true, especially on racial issues, which is what Earl Warren was most liberal about.
Donald Trump has reversed a previous statement. He now says that he might not accept the election results if Hillary Clinton wins on November 8th. Could that mean another case before the court like Bush v. Gore?
You know, you have to remember how crazily unlikely Bush v. Gore was to come before the court. You know, you had a single state which held the balance of, you know, 270 electoral votes went to the winner of that state. It was a couple hundred votes separated the two candidates. I don't see the court getting involved in this election, but I do think that, you know, that Donald Trump's insinuations that the election is rigged somehow could have pernicious effects down the line.
In the balance, the Supreme Court after Scalia is Jeffrey Toobin's latest article for The New Yorker. It's always a pleasure having
you. Wait, we got to talk about one more thing.
What?
That I will be speaking at the New Yorker Festival.
I was going to mention that.
Oh, were you going to mention that? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump on your line. But please, Leonard, continue.
Right after this. And as Jeffrey pointed out, he will be speaking at Acura at Sur Stage 37 as part of the New Yorker Festival this Saturday, October 8th at 10 a.m. That's at 508 West 37th Street. And then on Sunday the 9th at noon, he'll be signing books at McNally Jackson at 52 Prince Street. That's on the Patty Hearst book. For more information about both events, visit WMIC.org/Lopate.